The Rolling Stones with Brian Jones and Satisfaction, written in 1965.
A Story of Our Time. The story of Brian Jones, the young guitarist with the Rolling Stones group, who died tragically at the age of 26. The programme is introduced by Michael Whale.
The first time I met Brian Jones was in a pub in St Martin's Lane, London. We didn't stay long because the landlord said, "I'll serve you, but not your friend." That was in 1963, before the Rolling Stones were really known. But already they had had that instant effect of repulsion upon the middle-aged and those in authority. Not the least of the reasons was the fact that with their shaggy hair and dress-anyhow appearance, their image was the antithesis of the Beatles, who just burst upon the world, neatly kempt, singing nice, tuneful songs, wearing suits, and loved by children and parents alike. Brian Jones came from a middle-class Cheltenham background, which produced its own pressures. His father, Lewis Jones, was and is still an aeronautical engineer in Cheltenham, who, like every parent, had only wanted the best for his son.
He always was musical. Church music he was always very fond of, hymns. But it wasn't really until he became into his teens that he began to develop this liking in the early days, rather an insufficiently strong word perhaps, which became an absolute religion with him. He played the piano quite nicely. He'd had quite legitimate lessons from a very good teacher. But all the time his fanaticism for jazz music was coming to the fore. It was a great disappointment to us and a source of considerable anxiety when he became so wrapped up in his love of jazz music that in spite of everything we could do or say, he went off and did it. Because in the course of time, he proved us wrong. And I'll always say to his credit that he never came home and said, "I told you so." He only said with a rather wry smile, "Well, I haven't done so bad, Dad, have I?"
It was while still at school in Cheltenham that Brian Jones first met Alexis Corner.
Around about 1960, I was playing occasional dates with the Chris Barber Band, which at that time was a very, very popular band. And Chris's wife, Otterley Patterson, was doing a regular blues spot with the band, and I used to come in and play guitar, just for those 15 or 20 minutes. And one of the towns we visited during the tour was Cheltenham. And after the performance in Cheltenham, Brian came up to me together with a friend of his and started talking about blues, said he'd always wanted to know about blues, and, well, he just came into the dressing room and we started chatting. And about a fortnight later, I gave him my phone number and address and everything and said if he ever came up to London, because he was thoroughly miserable as an assistant in an architect's office. He didn't want to become an architect, but he was there because there was absolutely nothing else to do in Cheltenham, he maintained. So he was also playing with a small local jazz band at the time. And I gave him my address and phone number and everything, and he used to appear and sort of sleep on our floor and come round the odd clubs if I was playing anywhere, and then go back again on the Sunday night. And the same time, I was getting visits from Mick Jagger and Keith Richard, and Brian met them more or less. Well, in fact, he did meet them at our flat one night, and Charlie Watts was my drummer at the time anyway, so that was the Stones.
Up to a certain point, Brian was a perfectly normal, conventional boy who was well-behaved and was well-liked. Liked, I suppose, because he was well-behaved. He did his studies, and he was quite a model schoolboy. And then there came this peculiar change in his early teens, at the time, I suppose, he began to become a man, where he began to get some resentment of authority. It was a rebellion against parental authority, and it was certainly a rebellion against school authority. He often used to say, why should he do something he was told just because the person who was telling him was older?
So already there were the hints of the rebel, an image the Rolling Stones were to take up professionally. guided by the youthful Andrew Oldham, a former office boy with Brian Epstein, who'd first sold the Beatles to an unimpressed Fleet Street by hawking photos of them around the picture editors. Now Oldham set about selling his own group, the Rolling Stones. He had no money, neither did they. So he seized on the ingenious idea of taking them to other stars' press receptions. One day I was at a reception for Petula Clark. Suddenly, no one was taking any notice of her. They were all talking to these five shaggy-haired boys in another corner of the room. Oldham had won again.
I personally think that the enormous impact which the Stones made on the musical world generally was as much of a shock and surprise to them as individuals as it was to everybody else. It certainly came like a bolt from the blue to me. I clearly remember him ringing me up, almost speechless with excitement, saying that they were going to have a record produced. This surprised me, but I didn't really realize the significance of it. I thought perhaps it might have been just a private pressing which they were having done. But of course this was the record, Come On, which started the snowball, which got bigger and bigger.
On stage it was already Mick Jagger who caught the public's eye as the group's lead singer. As he gyrated out front, the other members of the group were slightly set back. But the eye was always drawn to Brian Jones, already a fine guitar player who beneath the boyish smile and almost girlish face had a certain hard-eyed look. The fans loved them, but from the start the relationships within the group were tense.
Mick and Keith were the songwriters. Mick was the face out front. The relationship between those three members in the group was always... It was a very strange setup. I mean, it would be Mick and Keith versus Brian, and then you'd then find Keith and Brian as the inseparables, calling Mick for everything, and then Mick and Brian against Keith. It was a very complicated setup. You certainly did have a very big chip on his shoulder.
The Stones were seldom out of the news. If their image was violent, then certainly it was mirrored in their very public private lives.
He was prone to violence when he was very drunk, but not generally against other people. I went with him to a club one night and we walked home and he kicked the dustbins and kicked the wall, and if he could possibly have thrown himself into the wall, he would have done.
There certainly was a self-destructive thing in him. There is in quite a lot of people I know. And if you're involved with music on an entirely emotional basis, it is extremely frustrating because you can rarely get out what you want to get out. And therefore, the element of frustration can be mistaken for an element of self-destruction. And I think there was more frustration than active self-destruction in Brian. As far as the drug side was concerned, well, I suppose at one time or another he'd tried practically everything. A lot of people in the business have at one time or another tried practically everything. Some of them have blown their minds to shreds and some have come through it.
One just has to understand the lifestyle of somebody like that. He was a musician, and there is a musician's mentality. A musician is a race apart, striking chords, playing whatever on the guitar. When one hears that back, it's like, it's a spiritual thing. It would be, I should imagine, like, I don't know, plasma. You know, it's like seeing or feeling, you got the very essence of oneself. God, it's so hard to explain if one isn't in there doing it.
Sometimes people's troubles only start with success, contrary to the public's view of them. For Brian Jones, this certainly seems so. Cliff Richard is a pop star who survived that same period.
I know before I made it, I'd been singing for 2 years and doing a regular job as well. So, I mean, that's real pressure stuff, I think. But it's the fame that's the real killer, I suppose. It's the actual sudden, you know, real popularity and suddenly finding that you can do anything and say anything and go anywhere that really grabs people. And I think once... I mean, it's a shame that there isn't a training course for coping with fame. I mean, you know, it really needs it.
To be a musician, one is always striving for some kind of self-honesty, I think. I think he was seeking honesty from others that probably he couldn't find in the groupie girls. I don't think he was narcissistic, but a lot of the girls did look like himself. No, but I think he was finding he had to rely more and more on himself.
I talked to a somewhat sleepy Mick Jagger about those pressures within the group which Michael Aldred talked about.
Brian was so sensitive, really. The beginning, you know, it was a sort of joke, you know, I mean, it was a good-natured joke. Because Brian was so sensitive to everything, you know, I mean, when people sort of said, it seems so ridiculous now anyway, I mean, 7 years ago, or so, wherever it was, people really used to get uptight, you know, and start carrying on at you because you were dirty or whatever they thought you were. Brian used to get very upset about it, or I mean, everyone else used to laugh it off, you know. Brian, it used to really hurt him, you know, the fact that people actually thought that he didn't wash his hair, you know, when he did.
Within the group, I mean, were the pressures, it is sometimes thought, or at least his father says, that he would have rather had some of his tunes played, rather like George Harrison, I suppose, with the Beatles.
Well, I didn't really understand what Brian wanted to do, really. Kept a lot of things to himself like that. He never played me a song he'd written, so it was quite hard to know what really if he wanted to do songs with us he'd written. I think he did, but he was very shy and all that, and I think he found it rather hard to lay it down to us, you know, that this was a song and it went like this. And we probably sort of didn't even think, because he didn't do it, didn't try and bring it out of him, probably. I mean, it wasn't a question of forcefully sort of stifling him.
In the beginning, the image and the sort of Andrew Oldham sort of imaged you as wild, rather uncouth guys. Did the image overtake Brian at any time?
I don't know. No, I mean, a lot of people say this kind of, put it in a nutshell, that Brian Jones lived to be a Rolling Stone more than anybody. I mean, whatever that means. I mean, it means vaguely that he sort of freaked out more than everybody, which is probably true. I mean, he did it in a very nice way, and he was very funny. I mean, we were more interested in just being disgusting and freaking out than playing music, you know. And I think that was a pity that we wasted a lot of time in that kind of thing, you know. And Brian probably did too, but I mean, I don't know, I don't think he considered it wasting his time, that's just my point of view. I mean, I wasted my time, you know, and all that. Still am.
What I firmly believe was the turning point in Brian's life was when he lost the only girl he ever really loved. I think this was a very severe blow to him. He changed suddenly and alarmingly from a bright, enthusiastic young man to a quiet and morose and inward-looking young man, so much so that when his mother and I saw him for the first time for some months after this happening, we were quite shocked by the change of his appearance, and in our opinion, he was never the same boy again. And it was at that time, I think, that he got mixed up with drugs, perhaps, if indeed he was. Whether he got mixed up with the wrong kind of people, or whether he just took to drugs, or in the way that many people take to drink, I don't know. I never shall know, but I'm quite convinced, I'll always be convinced, that that was the turning point in Brian's life, rather than the pop scene generally.
I think Brian suffered from pressures which were not necessarily of being a stone. I think Brian had private problems, like he wanted to be loved tremendously. He needed to be loved tremendously. He needed to have the kind of almost maternal love that, away from any other kind of love. He needed that very much more than anything else. I know he found a shoulder to cry on with my wife. He used to phone at odd intervals and talk to at great length about his problems.
Unlike other young people, his problems always became public property. A Sunday newspaper alleged that he had had more than one child by young women in London, each one called Julian. Then, on May 10th, 1967, Jones was arrested in his London flat and charged with the unlawful possession of cannabis. Jagger and Keith Richards, 6 weeks later, were found guilty on drug charges at Chichester Assizes. They were to appeal successfully. But meanwhile, the Times wrote a memorable leader about the case called Who Breaks a Butterfly on a Wheel? And I quote, "There are cases in which a single figure becomes the focus for public concern about some aspect of public morality. If we're going to make any case a symbol of the conflict between sound traditional values of Britain and the new hedonism, then we must be sure that the sound traditional values include those of tolerance and equity." Then, on October 31st, after a night in Wormwood Scrubs prison, Jones was sentenced to 9 months for possessing cannabis, a sentence also successfully appealed against. Soon after, he collapsed and was taken to hospital. A year later, he was again arrested on a charge of possessing cannabis. This time, he was fined £50, with £105 costs.
It's not for me to criticise the workings of officialdom, but I am absolutely convinced, and I shall always remain convinced, that Brian was unjustly convicted on the second of his drug charges. I pass no comment on the first, but on the second one I shall remain convinced the rest of my life that Brian was innocent of that charge. And I base this mainly on the fact that the very night it happened, he rang me up in a state of great distress because he was deeply concerned about how his affairs were affecting his family. And he swore to me that he was innocent of it, and he hoped that I would always believe him. I promised him on that occasion that I believed him, and nothing has ever or will ever change my mind.
I saw him once in the street, and he was totally destroyed. He mixed with the wrong people. But there were some people who kind of latched on to the fact that Brian was a big star, and I suppose as some kind of compensation for themselves, they would be the ones going out scoring the drugs, and they would all sit there. And Brian was very interested in, he would take LSD or SDP. I think I didn't really know him too well in those stages because I found myself alienated from, he was just such a nice person that I didn't like to see what he was doing.
The month before he was to die, Jones left the Stones to form his own group. By now, he had bought a country house in Sussex, and it was here, his new working base, that he began to plan his next move. His parents visited him.
We were down with him about 3 weeks before he died. Typical of Brian, we had a call in the early hours of the morning, full of bubbling enthusiasm about the beauties of his house, and the loveliness of the particular summer we were having at that time. And it had come down in the morning. Well, of course, this is easier said than done, and we couldn't come down in the morning, but I suppose this was about Tuesday. And we did, in actual fact, go down the following weekend, and we spent this weekend with him. We are particularly glad, of course, now that we went and that we were able to go, because we spent an intensely happy weekend with him, probably the happiest and closest weekend we'd spent with him since he was a child. And of course it was, in actual fact, the last time we ever saw him.
His old friend Alexis Corner also went down to Sussex.
I was in touch with Brian again because he needed to speak to someone who wasn't worried by the business. He needed to speak to someone who could help him to reorganize his musical thinking so that he could start playing again. And he wanted to go back to the position roughly in which he was at the time when he joined the Stones, because he had played occasionally with me and he used to come around the clubs with me and so on and so forth. And as I had remained there and was a reasonably calm center for him, as far as his memory was concerned, because he remembered the family and sitting at home and not having to be bothered by things. I got in touch with him again, and I re-established once again and very rapidly a very firm contact. And he said, I'm sorry I haven't seen you for all these years, and I said, that's all right, and that's all we said about it.
In July, Brian Jones died, accidentally drowned in his swimming pool during a midnight swim.
I almost felt if I'd gone down that day, I might have been able to prevent it. This is the normal reaction, and I very rapidly thought afterwards, well, no, it couldn't have been foreseen. There's no point in me thinking about it, because I was due to go down the day that he happened to fall into the swimming pool, and I couldn't get down there that day. So inevitably one thinks of that. And my next reaction was that, in a way, for Brian, it was a good thing. He really was happy at the time that he died, because he was getting this new band together. We were going to rehearse it. I wasn't going to play with him. He'd asked me to, and I'd said, no, I won't play with you, but I'll act as your rehearsal director, because you can't sit in the band and play and stand outside it and hear what it sounds like, and I'll give up all the spare time I've got to help you to get the band together and get it on the road, but I can't perform with you full-time. And he was talking very excitedly, and we'd laid some tracks down of things we wanted to do. I'm not sure that he'd have made it. At the time that he died, he was sure that he would have made it, and that's all that's important.
I think it was a terrible mistake. I really do. I went down in the early hours that morning when I was called to say that he'd been found in the pool, and I felt I'd lost a very good friend. I liked him tremendously. I make no apologies at all. I don't know what I can say, other than I found him a great conversationalist, rather remarkable monster, a lovely man.
I suppose there was a kind of feeling that I knew that Brian would, if anyone was going to die, Brian was going to die, kind of thing. I mean, I always knew that Brian wouldn't really live that long. He just really lived his life very fast, you know, so, you know. He was kind of like a butterfly.
I wasn't totally surprised. I hadn't seen him for a long time, and well, I was upset. I was so upset.
Oh no! Oh no!
The story of Brian Jones was written and introduced by Michael Whale. You also heard the voices of Brian Jones' father, Lewis Jones, Alexis Corner, Michael Aldred, Cliff Richard, and Mick Jagger. It was a BBC programme produced by Mitchell Raper.